Welcome to Introduction to the React Ecosystem. Today we're going to be exploring the massive React ecosystem, all the libraries, tools, and frameworks that are available you might not be familiar with if you're coming and to React for the first time. My name is Rami Sayar, and I'm a technical evangelist based in Microsoft Canada in Montreal. My job really is to work with developers, startups, and help them build their technologies on top of our platforms. And I specialize in web and open source tech. So anytime you've got any question about whether it's Microsoft Edge, HTML5 standards, JavaScript, Node.js, Python, PHP, feel free to send me a tweet at the @ramisayar.com or at ramisayar.com, my actual website. So on the agenda today is an introduction to React and the ecosystem. We're going to talk about React for a quick 5 minutes. If you're interested in learning more about React, there are other videos on Channel 9 that teach you React from the beginning. But today we're really going to focus on the ecosystem that surrounds React. So we're going to talk about Flux, what is Flux, the Flux architecture, some of the implementations like Redux. We're going to talk about Relay. This is really cool reactive database / API technology that's come out. And that's a fairly big part of the React ecosystem. We're going to talk about React Native, which is a way for you to build React applications for iOS and Android. And finally, we're going to talk about different dev tools that you might find very, very useful as you're building a React application. So I know it might be scary when you're coming towards a new library such as React, and you can't help but notice all the crazy amounts of stuff that's going on around this library. You can see so many different other libraries that you might need to include. There's build processes you might need to build. And React itself is not a framework. It's really a library. So let's actually dive in for a quick 5 minutes. But before that, I just want to mention and make sure that the objective of today's talk is to navigate the React ecosystem. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about how to build React applications. There's plenty of videos on Channel 9 if you're interested in that. But we're actually going to focus on the ecosystem, so basically everything that surrounds React. I'm assuming that you are an intermediate JavaScript developer, so you already know how JavaScript works. You might have already built a couple of web apps already. And the other assumption that I'm having is that you might have already played with React, and you're already maybe done some beginner course or some watched some tutorial, and you're looking to get a handle of all the stuff that's happening around React. So just to do a quick 5 minute introduction to React, I'm just going to highlight some points about the frame, the library itself that you'll find that we'll come back to as we sort of navigate around the ecosystem. So first of all, React is just a UI library. It was developed by Facebook, and really it lets you create interactive, stateful, and reusable UI components. Now, there's a clear emphasis on UI. React is really just a UI library. And the nice thing about React is that it can also be used on the client and the server side. So what that's going to do is it's going to let you put React and build that UI part on both your back end and your front end. And as a result, you're going to see all these tools that are going to come in and focus on one side or the other. And there are even tools and techniques that you can use so that you can merge the two together. So you can write the same React components for both the front end and the server side. The nice thing about React is that it also uses a virtual DOM to selectively render the subtrees of components that you create. So every time there's a state change, React will actually render the entire subtree of components. And what's really nice about that is it creates a very reactive application. And this virtual DOM also comes in handy when we're trying to render on the server side. We can tell React, instead of rendering directly to the DOM, to render to a string, perhaps, that we can then send over to the client side. Now, React adds this weird thing to your HTML called JSX. Now, JSX is going to come back. We're going to see it when we start talking about Babel and some of the other technologies that we might want to use with our React application. But it really, what it lets you do is it lets you write HTML-ish tags in JavaScript to simplify the creating of components. So I've got a little code sample here, and you can notice that it looks like JavaScript. We've got our Hello World component. We're calling React.clay class. This is clearly a JavaScript function. And then inside this render function, we're returning what looks like HTML tags. And that's what JSX lets you do. It lets you sort of merge the HTML and JavaScript parts together, and it sort of lets you put all of the data and interaction that you might be expecting from this UI component in the same place. So it simplifies the code a bit as well. especially if you're coming from a framework that's a more classical MVC, where we have templates that are completely separated from the actual controllers. In this case, we're sort of putting the two together. But again, this is just the view component. There's no MVC in React. It takes a different architecture completely, and you'll see that with Flux as we move along in today's presentation. One thing to remember is that if you want to add attributes to your React component, you can actually do that, and they're called props. Now, these props can be used to render dynamic data. So let's say that we had our hello name component, and we wanted to pass in a name, to say like hello to Rami, for example. That's what the props will let us do. So you can see in the code here, we're taking this dist.props.name. We're assuming that there's a name attribute that was passed into our hello name component the next time we created it. All of this you should have perhaps seen if you watch on one of the Channel 9 videos. This is actually really interesting, because the props and how we pass data around is what's going to govern some parts of the Flux architecture, which is part of this React ecosystem. So a couple of things you might want to take note of. The render method is probably the only required specification for creating a component. It's the only piece that's actually required. But React components can have different lifecycle methods. They could have a component will mount function that's invoked once on both the client and the server before any rendering occurs. This will come in handy when we're looking at building isomorphic or universal JavaScript applications. So these are applications that are like running the same code base on both the server and the client side. There's another function, another lifecycle method called component did not mount. Did mount. And should component update and component will unmount. Wonderful documentation can be found on the React site. We'll explain all of these lifecycle methods in detail. Just keep a note of some of these, because we're going to come back to them when we talk about Flux architecture and some of the tools that you can use to build isomorphic / universal JavaScript applications. So a couple of things just to keep in mind as well. Every component in React has a state object and a props object. Now, some of these functions, and this is really crucial, you're going to use these functions to set state. And this is actually going to come back when we talk about Flux architecture. So get initial state returns the initial value of the state for that component. Set state, that sets the state and triggers a UI update. So every time that you set the state and it changes, there's some update that takes place. Get default props, which sets the fallback property values if any props are not supplied. And then mixins are a way for you to extend the current component's functionality. So there's a couple of mixins that are available built into the React library that you can add to your components. So final notes on a little quick 5-minute introduction to React. React events are attached as properties and can trigger methods. So you can attach, let's say, a mouse click event in your inside your React component, and that can trigger a function that's inside your component. Now, another really key point here is that data in React flows unidirectionally via the state and props object. So as you're putting components inside each other and creating a hierarchy of components, data is going to flow in one direction. There's no bidirectional data like you might find in Angular or other frameworks. In React, everything is unidirectional, which lets us really create a reactive paradigm in our application. Now, React might seem to re-render the whole application on every single data change, so that means it re-renders the entire UI component tree. But really, what it actually does is renders only the parts that change. One other thing to remember is that if you want to assign CSS classes, you have to use the class name property. So this is, instead of having just the class in your HTML element, you actually have to add the name, and that's because the keyword class actually classes with the JavaScript keyword, hence why we've had to change it. Speaking of classes, if you're using ECMAScript 6, React also supports the ability for you to inherit from React classes with ECMAScript 6 classes. So you don't need to call the create class function. You can just extend the React component class, which is pretty cool if you're using ECMAScript 6. At the end of the talk, we'll mention a couple of tools that you can use to build the next generation of JavaScript, ECMAScript 6, so that it works with older browsers that only support ECMAScript 5. So you can still use the advanced functionality of classes in React if you want to, and still have it run on older browsers. So React is a UI library, and we mentioned that a couple of times. It only focuses on the UI, but we did see that there is some state that you can set for every single component. There's some properties that you can use to pass dynamic data. But really, like, how do you actually build the app state in a React application? And this is where the ecosystem has come into play. The React ecosystem is not just about the UI part. It's also about how do you build the application architecture around React. And it's not just the application architecture that you might find in the ecosystem, but it's also component libraries. So these are pre-built React components that you could use. There's also a different set of libraries that deal with how to handle data, and especially how to handle data in ways that work better with the React functional model. And we're going to cover that today. So this is sort of the main parts of the talk today, looking at these parts of the ecosystem. And the first thing that we're going to focus on is how does one build a complex application with React and what type of architecture you might use. So the first thing that you might want to know is that Facebook, when they first released React, they also subsequently released an architecture called Flux. Flux is the architecture that they use for building client-side web apps, and it's really more of a pattern than a framework. Although there is a library called Flux from Facebook that implements some of these patterns already for you. Flux doesn't follow MVC, so if you're familiar with MVC, if you're coming from an Angular background or a Ruby on Rails background, Flux is, as an architecture, does not follow that pattern. It favors instead having a unidirectional flow of data. If you think of Flux architecture, you take a look at it from a sort of a high-level view, it's composed of four major parts, the first being a dispatcher, then a store, views, and actions. And we're going to cover what each of these pieces do and how that forms a application architecture that you could use with React and take full advantage of React's ability to be both functional and reactive. So dispatchers are what you would call the central hubs that manage data flow. Essentially, what they are going to contain is callbacks into the stores. So when you create a store, it's going to register a callback into the dispatcher. So anytime there's an action that comes in that gets passed into the central dispatcher, they are then redistributed to these stores. And the other thing that dispatchers will do is they'll also manage dependencies between the stores. So let's say that there's a store that requires data to be passed to it first. Well, then the dispatcher will also handle that. Now, speaking of these stores, what do they actually do? What do they contain? They contain the application state and logic. If you really want to compare it to an MVC framework, this would be the M part, the model part. So these stores will actually represent how the data and the logic is actually stored in your application. The stores register themselves with a dispatcher, and they do that to receive actions via the callback that they registered. Actions are what describe state changes in the store. So let's say that we had a to-do list in our application. We're trying to write a to-do application. You might have a list of to-dos. These are going to be stored in the to-do store. And then anytime there's an action that changes the data in that store, say like a task has been completed, it's going to be passed in as an action to the dispatcher, who is then going to send it to the to-do store that will handle managing the business logic to see if there's anything that needs to be done with that action and actually store that data as a state. So stores will broadcast an event every time that the state does change so that the views that are listening to these states can update themselves. Now, the views are basically React components. They're composable. You can build them in a nested tree. That's some of the magic of React. You can have a bunch of composed components. There is one special app view that sort of behaves like a controller slash view, okay, in an MVC framework. And this is typically the React component that provides the glue code to propagate the state changes down the chain. And it's going to do that using the props that we mentioned earlier, so pass that dynamic data down. And each component is going to sort of set the state for that component that causes a re-render. So events cause the views to request the state. from a store. So the components are, the views are going to get that state from a store, and they're going to use set state so that the render function will be re-executed. Now, all of this information that's being passed around, ideally, it's actions that are describing a change, and then typically they might include a payload. So if we take a look at a simple diagram here, we have our application. It's already been set up. There's a dispatcher, okay, to which a store has already registered that they're listening to any type of action that describes this, something that they're interested in. And the view is the actual component. So let's say that a user might check off a task in our to-do app. That view is going to cause an action that gets sent to the dispatcher. The dispatcher is going to figure out, okay, well, which store actually cares about this? It's going to send it to the store. The store is going to figure out if there's any type of logic that it needs to execute, and then finally change the data and change the state. And when that state is changed, it causes a event to get thrown, and any view that's listening to that type of event will be able to get that state and re-render and then update the application. But you can see what something that's really interesting is that the entire data flow flows in one direction. So it goes from dispatcher all the way down to the view, and then if there's anything that happens, it goes back to the dispatcher, right? It's unidirectional. There's no bidirectional change of data here, like you might find in another MVC framework like Angular or Ruby on Rails. Now, Flux itself, as we mentioned earlier, is more of a pattern. It's not really a library, although there is a Flux library that's written by Facebook. There's a whole bunch of different Flux implementations, and each one have their merits and some of the negative parts from the way that they implemented it. Right now, the most popular Flux implementation, the two most popular ones, are the one that's written by Facebook, because they actually use it in their applications. And inside the front ends of their web apps, and Redux, which is a very simple implementation that takes some cues from Elm, which is a language that's designed very differently and meant for reactive applications. So they take some cues from Elm, and they've built a Flux implementation that actually reduces the amount of disparate objects that you might need to build in your application. So Redux is very interesting. There are other Flux implementations like Alt, Reflux, Fluxor, but the ones that I would recommend you start off with are the Facebook one and the Redux one. And in fact, I actually prefer the Redux one the most. And if you take a look at where it's hosted on GitHub now, it's now part of the main React.js organization on GitHub. So you can see that there's quite a bit of adoption around the Redux implementation of Flux. So if you were curious, okay, well, what does the Flux by Facebook application look like? It looks like this. It's, again, the Flux pattern. You've got an action creator that creates the actions that are then sent to the dispatcher. There's a callback that's sent back to the store. This causes the change event, perhaps even store queries. And then the React views get that information, and then they update the views. If there's any user interaction with the views themselves, it goes back to the action creators. Redux, though, on the other hand, tries to avoid a lot of this complexity. So the gist of Redux, and this is taken straight from the README page, the whole state of your application is stored in an object tree inside a single store. So there's only one store that you need to worry about in a Redux application. So that means that the central dispatcher doesn't basically do very much, right? It sends the same actions to the same store. So the only way to change the state tree is submit an action, which is an object that describes what changed, and to specify how actions transform the state in that store, you write these functions called reducers. And what their job is to do is basically take an input and figure out what changes it makes to the state tree in a very, very functional, simple way. And you can actually compose these reducers together so that you can chain multiple events, multiple state changes and actions, which is pretty cool. But at the end of the day, it's meant to be very functional, very simple, which makes it actually very easy for you to test as well. Now, if you're interested in actually learning a lot more about Redux, you can go to github.com/react.js/redux. So that was all that we wanted to talk about when it comes to Flux architecture. There's plenty of different implementations, but honestly, I would recommend you take a look at Redux. It's the simplest. It simplifies the whole architecture, so you don't have to worry too much about dispatchers and action creators and all of that, you can focus instead on writing functions that do state manipulations that are easy to test and easy for you to sort of rewind in case there's a you wanted to debug the application. I'll actually show you some really cool tools to help you rewind your application. Now, the next thing that I sort of want to talk about is other libraries that you will find in the React ecosystem that will be very, very helpful. Okay. The first one is React Router. So now, as we said, React is very much a UI framework, a UI library. It doesn't actually care so much about the URL of where you are on the page and like in your page hierarchy of your website. It actually doesn't really care at all about that. It's meant to be a single-page application. But let's say that you do care about the URL and you actually want to have multiple different URLs, or even within the same single-page application, you want to be able to tell the user, here's this is where they are at in the application, so by changing the URL, you can use a library called React Router. React Router basically keeps the UI in sync with the URL. And it's got a couple of really useful features, among them lazy code loading, dynamic route matching, and even local location transition handling. These are all built in. Now, to actually create a route using a React Router, it's actually really simple. You use the same components, language components framework that you've been using with React. Right, so you might already be familiar with this. And with the case of React Router, what you're going to do is you're going to create a router component, okay, and give it a path, route path, and then this path will actually set the component that you want to execute. So if it's a path that starts with slash and has about, then you're going to get the about component, etc. Now, if you're using Redux already, there's a way for you to sync your Redux state. Your routing state directly with your Redux store, so the application can keep a track of where it's been, and you can use the React-Router-Redux library to actually do that. Another really useful library that you'll find in the React ecosystem is called Reselect, and this is going to be interesting because it's a selector library for Redux. And what that's going to let you do is it's going to let you compute any derived data that you might have in your state. And this lets you keep the state object in Redux very, very simple. So let's say that you had a total price for an object, okay? You're running an e-commerce store and you're selling this, let's say it's a hat, and there's a total price for it, okay? Because this total price is going to be composed of perhaps the tax, depending on who you're selling to and what region of the world you're selling it to, and the actual gross price of the product, okay? So let's say that you wanted to keep that in your state, okay? There's no need for you to keep the total price if you're using a reselector, the Reselect library. You can compute that derived data on the fly, and if there's a price change in your React application, the rest of the data is automatically and quickly recomputed. So you don't have to worry about updating the data in multiple parts in your state object. You just update one, and then the Reselect library will do the rest. And it's an efficient way of handling computed derived data, so you don't need to recompute unless the arguments change. And the nice thing is that you can also compose these selectors together. So you can build, you can build the total price selector, but you can also compose it with, say, like a price reduction selector because an item might be on special. And you don't need to worry about saving that entire state individually for that object. You can instead set compute the derived data. This is a complex example. You can actually take a look at the Reselect library. The README page will actually take a look at how that's explained, and you'll be able to see how that works. Another really handy library is ImmutableJS. ImmutableJS, also written by Facebook, it provides essentially immutable collections and data structures. So what does that mean? Once you have an immutable structure, it means that once it's created, it cannot be altered at any other point. So let's say that we were creating a tree. If we try to make a change to the tree, it actually won't change the original tree. But if we're using this library, it'll create a whole new tree that is and keep both of them to be valid. So that means it's also persistent. So both the original and the Mutic collections are both valid. The other really cool thing about this library is that it does have a couple of things that you would want so that you don't end up with very bloated memory for your app, okay? Because if you're creating a new structure every single time that you create a change, you might end up with lots of duplicate copies of the same data. So Immutable.js actually provides what we call structural sharing. So new collections that are created using the same structure as the original collection, so that way you can reduce the copying that we need to do, and we can also achieve the space and the performance efficiencies that we might want. So some of the structures, the data structures that are available in Immutable.js, the ones that are there, like list, stack, map, ordered maps, sets, ordered sets, and record. Now, you can use this in combination with Redux. It's actually a really well-promoted practice to have Immutable.js and Redux together. That way, you can quite easily maintain state and make it very easy for you to rewind in case that there's incorrect changes to your state. Now, we mentioned actions, and these actions describe the type of state changes that are happening. There's actually a library that helps you write these actions in a way that's sort of standardized, and this is called Flux Standard Action. It's human-friendly syntax, and it's designed for action objects. And essentially, it says a couple of things. Action objects must be plain JavaScript objects, and they have to have a type property. So this type property will describe what type of action it is. And they can also have an error, a payload that might contain the data that you might be passing in with that action, and a meta property. Now, what's really cool is that you can use this Flux standard action library with Redux actions. So it's a Redux actions library that sort of gives you a set of helpers to create and handle these Flux standard action objects in Redux. And there's another library called Redux Promise, and it's a promise middleware that also supports Flux standard actions. Now, React, as we mentioned, is a UI component library, so of course there's a set of libraries out there that give you React components already built in. So these are components that you could just drag into your application. They'll do a set number of actions for you. They'll have a couple of properties, and they'll just make your process of building an app much faster. So the one that we first have to mention, of course, is that React Bootstrap library. Bootstrap, as you might already know, is a CSS framework that's extremely popular. I feel like every time I go on the internet, I end up on sites that look all the same, and that's because they're all using Bootstrap nowadays. And essentially what React Bootstrap does is it wraps the Bootstrap components into React components. So to give you an example, let's say that you are building a button group in your HTML and you're using CSS. The Bootstrap CSS to do that. Well, instead of having to write the classes every single time, you just write button group. This is a component that's introduced in the React Bootstrap library. So you don't have to worry about the HTML and the CSS classes that you need to add to make this set of elements behave like a button group. You can just use the components, and then that gives you the wonderful sort of simplicity of using the same React components with the same with your other components as well. So you don't have a mixture of HTML and React components, you can just have all React components in the same render function. Now, of course, if we mention Bootstrap, we have to mention Foundation, which is another CSS framework that's extremely popular as well. Foundation is a bit of a competitor to Bootstrap. It takes quite a few different approaches, but fundamentally, they're both CSS frameworks. React Foundation essentially is a new framework for building web apps. This is straight from the README documentation. It has awesome new features like Flexbox-based grid, motion UI, and several core components for building web apps. If you use the React-Foundation-Apps library, you'll get the Foundation equivalent of some of the components that you would expect in Bootstrap. So you can choose either one. You don't have to focus. You don't have to only use Bootstrap or only use your own HTML CSS styling. You can use Foundation as well, Bootstrap, and you can also build your own if you so wanted to. There's another one that's interesting, and it looks a little familiar to Bootstrap. I'm not sure to what extent it is actually based off Bootstrap, but you'll notice that the styling looks a little bit similar. It's called Elemental UI, and it's a UI toolkit for React.js websites and apps. Here's an example of how it does buttons. You can write button as your React component, give it a size, whether it's large, small, default, extra small. It will essentially work very similar to React Bootstrap and React Foundation. Khan Academy in Silicon Valley has also created their own React component library, and they've essentially built it as a collection of some of their most useful components and reusable components from Khan Academy. Essentially, what they're trying to do is make it easy to jumpstart React applications with well-tested, thoughtful, and beautiful library components. And to get to it, you can just go to khan.github.io/react-components, and you'll get Khan Academy's library of React components. Now, we mentioned that several times that there's state, right? And state will contain data. Now, of course, if we have state running in our browser, the minute we close the browser and we haven't saved that state anywhere else, all the user's data and all the user's actions will just disappear, right? So what we want to do is actually save some of that state maybe on a server in the backend in a database, or maybe save it to local storage in the browser. And to do that, there's actually a couple of libraries that introduce new techniques in the React ecosystem to make it really easy to save data and in a way that works with the very functional reactive architecture that Flux introduced along with React when they first were introduced to the public. So we're going to talk a little bit about handling data and side effects in React, and I'm going to show you three different libraries. And the first one is actually called Relay. Relay is also built by Facebook. It's a JavaScript framework for building data-driven React applications. And it works in a similar fashion to how React works. Like, it has similar properties in the sense that both are declarative, so you're writing what the components are doing, right? As if you're writing a sort of an HTML element. So it's very declarative. And Relay, in this case, uses a language called GraphQL, okay, to declare the data requirements. And then you let Relay figure out when and how to get this data. So you can set it up to basically say, hey, I need this data, or I need to do this thing to this data. And Relay will figure out, okay, well, now is a good time to go get it because the internet's available, the network connection is available, or now is the time I need to do it, etc. Now, the other cool thing about having sort of declarative data is that you can actually co-locate it right next to the views. So queries live next to the views if you're using a Relay, and Relay will actually aggregate the queries that might be being repeated. So let's say that you're trying to get the same piece of data several times for different React components in your page. Relay will actually aggregate all those queries so that you only send it to your server or backend once instead of having it the same data being transferred multiple times. Something that's really cool about Relay is that it lets you mutate the data on the client and the server also using the GraphQL language, okay? So you can write mutations to the data and then sort of sequence these mutations and have it essentially go from an initial state to the end state. Again, this reminds us of how React is actually built. There, and especially if we're using Flux, there's these actions that describe these state changes. Essentially, what we're doing here is we're mutating the data using GraphQL. So it's sort of like we're writing a bunch of different actions that change the data or the state, and we're sort of saving that as well. So that's something that's really cool about GraphQL and Relay. And in fact, Netflix has actually also released a library that's fairly similar. It has similar properties, and it's called Falcor. Falcor is a JavaScript library for efficient data fetching, and essentially it has these features. It uses one model everywhere. Okay, so it represents remote data as if it's a JSON graph. So this is actually pretty cool because it means that you can treat the data as if it was an object, and this object can be anywhere. So your entire Redux state object basically could be your entire database that you send and use with Falcor. Now, what's really cool about this is that you can represent this entire object the same way on in the memory or on the client side, or and even on the server side. So if you're basically wanting to build an isomorphic application where you're using the same React components on both the server and the client side, the same code base, well, if you're using Falcor, you're literally doing the same thing on both the server and the client. This is something that's really cool, very similar to Relay as well. Now, data in Falcor is the API. So if you know how to access the data in your JSON object, well, then you'll know how to use Falcor because you're going to just use the same operations like get, set, and call. Now, something that's really cool, and if you're wondering, okay, well, if this data is sitting in my memory and it's the same everywhere, well, how does it actually connect to a database? How does it connect to the cloud? Well, Falcor actually lets you bind to the cloud. And what Falcor will do is automatically transverse all your references in your graph, and it will make the requests as needed. So you don't have to worry about you yourself calling the REST API to save the data. Falcor will handle that behind the scenes. And of course, it will if there are multiple requests that are basically doing the same thing, or they're either getting the data from the same place, it'll actually aggregate all of these requests so that it's very efficient on the network. And that's something that's really cool. It also takes a hints from Relay that they both sort of aggregate the requests that you're doing so that you don't have to, you don't end up with lots of duplication of the data that's being sent in, back and forth on the network. And this is something that's really cool. These are very new libraries that are being built and developed as we speak. And they approach data handling in your front-end applications in a very different way than what you might have been used to if you're using an MVC framework. So with these two libraries, you actually don't have to worry at all about doing the API request yourself. You just declare the data that you want, or you write, you access and call and get and send the data how you would expect to in a programming language. And then you let these libraries handle the actual network saving to the database, the REST API parts themselves. So you don't have to worry about that at all anymore. Now, let's say that that's too advanced, or it doesn't have the things that you needed to do. And you wanted to go back to more of the older way of using a REST API and being able to call a specific API to save different types of data. Well, there's actually a library called React Resolver, and what that lets you do is define the data requirements per component. Now, this is pretty interesting because what that will let you do is for every single component that requires the data, you can use the REST API to just get it for that component. So the way you would write it is, let's say that we had a user profile, and here we are using ECMAScript 6. So this user profile component extends React.component. We can add this keyword up here, at resolve, okay? And what this will do is it will get the user, for the user, you'll get the props, okay? So it will actually return the HTTP GET for the API users, props being the user ID that you're perhaps trying to get for this user profile. So you can see that it will handle getting this data in an async way, and it'll render both on the server and client for you. Now, what's really cool about this is that you're using essentially the same APIs that you might already have or you might already be comfortable with, and you're using them to resolve the data that you need in a way that works. So now that we've talked about how to handle data in React, one of the really cool things about the React ecosystem is that not only are there component libraries, data libraries, architecture patterns, but there's also the ability to write native applications using React as well. So this falls under the React ecosystem in the sense that there are other projects that build on top of React to basically let you do this. And React on mobile is done mostly with a project called React Native. React Native is also written by Facebook and enables you to build on native platforms using JavaScript and, of course, React. And React Native focuses on essentially one thing, which is developer efficiency. So the idea here is that if you already have built React applications for the web, you only need to learn once, to learn React once, and then you're able to use the React way of building applications to write everywhere and write anywhere. So right now, React Native supports iOS and Android. There's a couple of other projects that I won't cover today, but you might be interested in them. For example, like React-Desktop, which lets you build applications for Windows and Mac. And there's lots of activity happening around this space, especially around React Native. And some of the really wonderful things is that you, again, learn once. You learn React once, and you're able to write everywhere. And it uses some of the powerful parts of that platform, so the native parts, to be able to accomplish that. So let me actually explain React Native, because I just alluded to it there. Let me actually explain how it works. So when you're building your React components, what you want to do is, instead of having a render to the HTML part, perhaps we could just render to the actual native platform, right? So that's actually what React Native does. It uses standard platform components, such as, like, let's say, the UI tab bar on iOS or the drawer on Android. And what that lets you do is create applications that use native components, where you're still writing that React part in JavaScript, but the part where you're writing HTML, you're actually just replacing it with the native components. And what that lets you do is it lets you have applications that are essentially are built using the JavaScript as sort of the business logic, but the UI part using the native components, so you'll have a native look and feel and a consistent look and feel with the rest of the platform. And as well have native performance, okay? Because typically the JavaScript engines on iOS and Android are now very, very fast. So your business logic will actually execute very quickly, but the UI part is native anyways, so it executes at the same speed as other native apps when it comes to drawing and rendering the actual components. So operations between this JavaScript part and the native platform are all done asynchronously as well, which is pretty cool. So you won't have your application buttons, for example, getting blocked when you click on them because the JavaScript code is still executing. Actually, everything is done asynchronously so that you don't have to. So you actually get almost a full native performance. Now, some of the nice things is that because we're already serializing between the JavaScript code that's running in the application and the UI part, what that lets you do is, if you're already serializing it, why don't you just communicate it with, say, your developer tools? So you can actually use your standard developer tools that you're already using to debug your React apps, and we'll cover some of them towards the end of this talk, to actually debug both in the simulator and on the physical device. So you're able to debug the JavaScript as if it was running sort of locally, but it's sitting in a simulator on a physical device. So now that we've covered React Native, we mentioned that there's a couple of tools that help you debug things. And actually, these are tools that are extremely handy for building not just on the native parts, but also on the web application parts as well. So the first tool that I sort of want to cover, it's sort of the standard dev tool for React, and that's the React Chrome Developer Tools. It's essentially an extension to Chrome that adds a React tab in your Chrome DevTools. And what this tab does that's really, really handy is it shows you the list of React components, sort of the hierarchy of components that you have in your React application. And then you can actually navigate between the components and see what properties have been set, and see the state of that component, and even see what the events are being listened to in that component. So it's actually really powerful, especially as you're declaring your React components. You can see what they actually look like in the HTML browser, sort of navigate through them and figure out if data is being passed correctly or if state is being set correctly in each different component, and essentially be able to explore your React app as if it was a regular HTML document. Now, here's a really cool library that I absolutely adore. It's called React Transform. Okay, essentially, it uses a Babel plugin, okay, to do a couple of things. Okay, so Babel, if you're unfamiliar with it, it's a library and tool that lets you sort of compile ECMAScript 6, ECMAScript 7, JSX into ES5. We'll actually talk a little bit more about it in a second. But essentially, I just wanted to mention the React Transform first. What this React Transform lets you do is it essentially lets you wrap your React components with arbitrary transforms. In other words, it allows you to instrument the React components in any way that you like. So you can sort of add things to them, or maybe even save state and changes. So there's a couple of plugins for this plugin, and among them is the HMR plugin that basically lets you do hot reloading, okay? So this enables you to hot reload components. There's the React Transform Catch Errors plugin that lets you catch errors inside the render function, so where it renders the HTML and the actual components itself. There's the React Transform Debug Inspector that basically renders an inline prop inspector directly into your component. And there's the Render Visualizer, which lets you highlight components when they're being updated. So here's an example. We've got a GIF that's running on the screen. Here we are. We have a React component. Let's say that I want to change the value of the increment. Okay. The nice thing about this is it will actually hot reload the code without you having to refresh the page. And it's doing that all using Babel. Okay. So the Babel piece will compile the JSX, will compile the JavaScript, and then will hot reload it into your application. So you don't have to refresh the browser page. So it's very similar to browser sync in that sense, unless you sync the document with the browser, but here where it's doing it directly with the React components. We've also got another tool that I think is extremely handy, especially if you're building native applications. It's called Code Push, and this is a way for you to push code updates to your apps sort of in an instant way. Now, you know that React Native still uses JavaScript, okay? So with this cloud service, it's actually developed by Microsoft. It enables both Cordova and React Native developers to deploy app updates directly to the devices. Okay, so you can send the code directly and basically push these changes so that the users can see them right away without having to actually update the app in the store. The other thing that you could also do is manage alpha, beta, and production apps. And it's both Cordova and React Native ready. And to actually check out this service, you can go to codepush.tools. Now, we mentioned Babel quite a bit. Essentially, the way you have to think about Babel is it's like a tool that helps you go back in time. Okay, so in other words, it takes you from ES6, ES7, so this is the next generation of JavaScript, as well as not just ES6 and ES7, but sort of additions to the JavaScript languages, like, say, JSX, okay? And it lets you take these sort of future tech, I guess, and go back in time to ECMAScript 5, okay? And what that lets you do is it'll actually let you run it, run your code on platforms that don't natively support ES6, okay, so older browsers, for example, as well as the JSX code itself to be just basically compiled down to JavaScript. So Babel is that compiler. Now, if you're wondering, are there any other ES6 compilers? Well, yes, there are. There's one called Google Traceur, but I think Babel right now is the most popular one, and it has a plugin architecture that sort of lets you add these other plugins, among them the React Transfer plugin that we just saw a second ago. So if you're building a Babel script, basically you can give it all the plugins that you need, the React support as well built into Babel. Essentially what that'll let you do is actually have a very, very advanced workflow that takes your code from your editor, compiles the JSX into the JavaScript pieces, lets you use the ES6 class components, and compile it down as well to JavaScript that runs on older browsers, push that to your actual browser, and sort of you can see the changes live as you're writing them in your editor. The minute you press save, which is really, really awesome. It's actually amazing, especially if you're coming from other languages and frameworks where you're not able to quite quickly see the changes that you're writing to the CSS because it's running in different languages or sitting on a server somewhere, and you have to actually manually refresh the page every time you want to see a change. And that's something that's really cool about React and these new technologies that we're using and are being developed today. So if you want to go back in time with Babel, you first got to install it. You can npm install with the --- save dev Babel CLI. This will set up Babel, and if you want to actually set it up, all you need to do is just call Babel from your command line, pass in the source file, maybe give it the output file that you want, and then here's where we set the presets, okay? This presets part, the switch in our command line, is actually really, really important because this is where we can tell Babel to recognize the source files as containing things like ES6 features or React features or JSX, ES7 features, and a whole bunch of other things. So now, okay, if you're wondering, okay, well, the ecosystem is so big and there's so many tools out there and so many things that I want to include in my project, but I don't want to actually have to manually figure out how all these pieces fit together. Well, that's okay because we've actually got tools that put everything together. So that's what we're going to focus on right now. The first sort of project that I actually really like is called the React Static Boilerplate. Essentially, it's a static website starter kit, okay? So what that means is that your entire website, it doesn't need a backend, okay? It's got the React parts built in, it's got the all the other pieces built in, and it just basically generates these static HTML pages. And then what you can actually use it for is to generate these static HTML pages from the React components themselves, okay? And it will generate routes based on the list of files in the pages folder. So this is a really cool starter kit. Okay, and essentially, if you've written your React app, you can get the straight HTML that you're going to get from it, the HTML and the JavaScript, and then all of a sudden, you can just put it up online and it works. And it's got a bunch of other features. It uses next-generation JavaScript using Babel, that compiler technology that we talked about. It has SAS syntax support via post-CSS and pre-CSS. It's got a development web server with browser sync and React Transform, so you're able to get that wonderful functionality that just automatically changes things in your document as you type them out. And of course, it bundles and optimizes your JavaScript files using Webpack. And if you wanted to, there's even a Yeoman generator for it so that you can use Yeoman. So this is pretty cool because essentially it creates a static website from your React components that you can then just take, copy-paste into an FTP folder somewhere and have it accessible on the web and working right away. Now, let's say that we wanted to build an isomorphic application. So this is an application where we have the same JavaScript code running on the back end and the front end. So your React part works on the back end. It generates the component when you first browse to that page. It then sends it as an HTML document, and then the React on the front end picks up where it left off on the server. So React Starter Kit is one of those projects. It's very opinionated. Boilerplate for basically building these applications, and it uses the Facebook's React library. It uses Node.js and Express and Flux architecture, and it has a bunch of modern web development tools built in already for it, including Webpack, Babel, and Browser Sync. There's another framework if you don't like the previous one. It's called Mern, and it's billed as the easiest way to build isomorphic JavaScript applications using React and Redux. So it uses Redux here. And essentially, it's a scaffolding tool that makes it really easy for you to build these isomorphic apps. And it uses Mongo, Express, React, and Node.js as sort of part of the base boilerplate for your application. So now, we've talked about all this wonderful stuff, and React really is one of those technologies that it's truly, I think, a game changer for the JavaScript world. It changes how we actually approach building JavaScript apps. Like, it's a whole different architecture, and it's a complete departure from the architectures that we've been familiar with in the past, like MVC. So React doesn't really follow any of those architectures, and it provides us with features that are actually extremely powerful. Hot code reloading, being able to sort of change your components right away, being able to wrap components and compose them together so you can have a whole subtree of UI elements that are with each UI element relatively being independent from each other. So it's a really powerful way for you to actually build applications. And that power also translates to building application to native platforms as well, using the same library and patterns and techniques that you've learned when you're building React web applications. You can use that set of practices, those techniques, and use that knowledge that you've accumulated and use it to build native applications with React Native. So I really have seen the future, and I really like this image that I have on the screen because I've seen the future, and it's in my browser. It's the browser technologies that we have that we are building today that are going to let us build the applications for the next generation. So hopefully you had a good time today with us, and just sort of as a summary, what did we actually learn? We introduced React and the ecosystem that surrounds React. We talked about Flux architecture. We introduced different React libraries that you can use, some UI component libraries as well. We introduced these new ways of actually accessing and describing and declaring data requirements for our applications through the libraries called like Relay, Falcor, and even React Resolver. We've introduced React Native, and I've also shown you some useful React dev tools. So that's all of the stuff that we covered today. And hopefully you'll have a better handle of the ecosystem that comes into React, so you're not scared to approach React, and you're not scared to take a look at all the stuff that's happening in this space. And that's really cool. So thank you so much. If you have any questions, one of the best ways to reach out to me is actually through Twitter. You can use at Rami Sayar, that's my handle. Feel free to tweet at me at any time. And if you're curious about other presentations that I've done, I actually have most of them up on GitHub. So you check out my GitHub account. It's github.com/Sayar. That's my handle. And you'll be able to see other projects and other presentations up there as well. So here's some resources and references in case you want to learn more about different parts of the ecosystem. These are great articles that I found, including the complementary tools page that lists every single complementary tool that exists to React in the ecosystem. But that's pretty much the end of today. Thank you very much, and hopefully we'll see you next time.